I'm glad you're here tonight. I want to talk about what is God to you? What is God to you? When you think about God, what does that mean to you? Who is God to you? I want to talk to you about who God is to me. The things that I see. I want you to understand, God is my rock. He is my stronghold. He is my fortress. He is my strength. He is my everything. In fact, in Psalm 18, in verse 2, he begins, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer. My God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold." In verse 31, he goes on and says, "For who is God but the Lord, and who is a rock except our God?" In verse 46, he continues, "The Lord lives and blesses me. Blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation." In fact, I want you to think about the fact that that the Bible also compares God's word to a rock. It is also a rock that I can depend upon. In Matthew 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, in verse 24, Jesus says, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on a rock." It is a foundation. It is the foundation for life. His word is a foundation for living righteously. His word is not shaken, because his word is my support. It's my foundation. I cannot be shaken. God is my rock. He is a firm foundation. He is the one I can always count on. I can always trust him to be there when I need him. He will not desert me because he is my rock. But he is also my rescuer. He's my redeemer. In fact, we are told that there was going to be, in Isaiah 59 and verse 20, that there was going to be a redeemer that would come to Zion and to those who turn from transgression in Jacob, and to those who would turn from transgression into Jacob. He's a redeemer. Talking about Jesus. He's a redeemer for those who turn from sin. He cannot redeem those who will not. You think about that? Those who will not turn to the Redeemer cannot be saved from their sins. Paul quotes from one of David's Psalms in Romans 4 and in verse 7 when he says, "Blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven and whose sins have been covered." Covered by the blood of the Redeemer. He has rescued me from every lawless deed and every sin. In fact, the Hebrew writer quotes from Jeremiah in Hebrews 10 and verse 17, "And their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more." What a wonderful thought. What a wonderful thought. Remember them no more. You know, one of the bad things about sin is when I realize I've sinned and understand I've sinned and I come forward and I confess it and I repent, there are others who know about that sin, but it's not so easy for them to forget that sin, is it? It's not always easy for me to forget those sins that I have committed, even though I've repented of them. And I know God has forgiven me because I have a Redeemer. It's not easy to forget them the way God does. It's just like he wipes the slate clean and it's gone. But sometimes they come back for us, don't they? That's what makes God so great. He's such a rescuer who can redeem me from every lawless deed. And he did it by giving himself. Titus 2 and verse 14, who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself. Notice the reason for doing this was to purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous of good deeds. In fact, remember the reason that God brought Israel out of Egypt was to have a people for himself. But they just became totally unfaithful. And he rejected them. But now he has, through the blood of his son, redeemed another people, a people from every nation under heaven, for his own possession through that shed blood. In 1 Peter 1 and verses 18 and 19, Peter tells me that he rescued me through his own blood, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with precious blood as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. He was without sin. And he went to the cross and he shed his blood so that he could rescue us, rescue me from my sins. But he is also my reprieve. He's my shelter. He's my refuge in a time of trouble. Joel says in chapter 3 and in verse 16, the Lord roared from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth tremble. But the Lord is a refuge for his people and a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Just before we began, Gary and I were talking about the fact, was it you and I? Now I don't remember who was, somebody and I were talking. It went somewhere. Anyway, we were just talking about the fact about God coming down on Mount Sinai. And that roaring, the thunder and the lightning, the thick smoke. And the earth is trembling. And the people are terrified. And I said, yeah, and I think I'd been terrified too if I'd been there. But think about it. God is our shelter. This one who has all power, clearly demonstrated in the things that he has done and shown us. You see, God is a shelter in a time of storm. The psalmist, again, in Psalm 61, and in verse 4 says, let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me take refuge in the shelter of your wings. I think we sing a song about being under the wings. In fact, it reminds me of what Jesus says when he's looking out on Jerusalem. And he says, I was like a hen who would gather her chicks under her wings, but you would not. He wanted to protect them, but they wouldn't have anything to do with it. God is our shelter. He is our place of refuge. He is a place of security. We also sing a song, a shelter in a time of storm. Yeah. He is a shelter. In the most difficult times of my life, only God has gotten me through. He is a place I can take refuge when life's dangers threaten. Nahum in chapter 1 and verse 7 says, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knows those who take refuge in him. Again, note what the psalmist or the prophet says. He knows, God knows those who take refuge in him. He's a stronghold in the time of trouble. He is a shelter in the time of storm, and he knows those who belong to him. And he will shelter him. Again, going back to that picture of Jesus looking over Jerusalem, it's almost like I can see him shaking his head. I wanted to shelter you under my wings, but you would not. God knows whose are his. God, God is my bodyguard. God is my bodyguard. There is no one who can protect or shelter or shield me like God. In Genesis 15 and in verse 1, it says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be great. I want you to think about it just for a moment. This is said right after Abraham has defeated the five kings. And it's just before Abraham says, what are you going to give me? I don't have any children. Someone else is going to be my inheritor. And God says, I'm going to give you a son. I'm going to give you a son. God has protected. God protected him in all of those things. The psalmist in Psalm 144 in verse 2 says, my loving kindness and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield, and he in whom I take refuge, who subdues people under me. One of the things that I picture about this idea of a bodyguard or a shield or protector is, he's in front and I'm behind and I'm back here cowering behind him and just following along as he goes through ahead of me. That's what I see God. He is always there. I can always count on him. He will not forsake me. He will not desert me. In 2 Samuel 22, in 2 Samuel 22 and in verse 3, David says, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior, save me from violence. You think about all of the things that David faced in his life. And the only place, the real place he could turn for consolation, for comfort, was to God. Wasn't it? Always look to God in times of great difficulty. I remember as you read and you think about, they went to bring the Ark of the Covenant back to its rightful place. And they're doing it the wrong way. And when death happens, David is greatly grieved. In fact, I think he's, in some ways you might say, he was angry with God. But then he realizes, when God says, choose what your punishment's going to be. You can fall into the hands of your enemies. And David's response to all of that was that he would fall into the hands of his God. Because David understood about God was that he was merciful. The enemy would not be merciful, but God would be merciful. And God was merciful. He didn't destroy them all. You see, his place. I can take refuge when life's dangers threaten me. He will shield me in those times of difficulty. Those hardships, he will be there for me. He is my lawyer. He's my lawyer. I remember Job in Job 13 and verse 3 and also in verse 15 wanting to argue his case before or with God. And as I thought about this, I thought about the fact that Job does not know why all of this is happening. He just sees himself as an innocent victim here. But if Romans 3:23 is accurate, then Job has also been a sinner in his life. Maybe there's some hidden sin that he doesn't know about. He wants to defend himself before God, but he really can't do it, can he? Because he doesn't know all of the facts. He really can't see why and what's going on, can he? No. No, but in Job 16, he says, "Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high." I want to bring my case before you, Lord. I just don't know all of the facts, but I know you know. You've seen. There isn't anything that escapes God's notice. And that's why he is the best lawyer you could possibly have. Because he doesn't have to rely on what you think or what you've seen. Because he knows all. And John says, we have the attorney. My little children, he goes on in chapter 2 and verse 1. I'm writing these things to you that you may not sin. Here's the reason I'm writing. I'm writing so that you will not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Are we not thankful that Jesus Christ is our lawyer? He's the one that goes between us and the judge. He's the one who will defend us in that time when we stand before the ultimate judge. He is my constant help. He fights against those who fight against me. The psalmist again in Psalm 35 and verses 1 through 3 writes, "Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of buckler and shield and rise up for my help. Draw also the spear and the battle axe to meet those who pursue me. Say to my soul, I am your salvation." That's his dependence. David's dependence on God is clearly seen in this to fight all of his battles. God, David knew. Think about it. When he went to meet Goliath, he knew who was on his side. He has no doubt. He trusts completely in God, doesn't he? He doesn't know whether he will live or die when this is over, when this day's done. He don't know whether he'll be alive or dead. But in facing this Philistine, he knows who is on his side. And so he can go before that Philistine with confidence. Because God is a constant helper. He will always be on the side of the righteous. Again, in Psalm 28 and verse 7, "The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusts in him, and I am helped. Therefore, my heart exalts, and with my song, I shall thank him." You see, the reason that God is such a constant help is because God never changes. That's why he can be my constant help. In Hebrews 13 and verse 8, it says, "Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." There is no shifting sand with God. There is no shifting shadow, James says in the first chapter in verse 17. "Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow." There's not even the movement of the shadow with God. He is that consistent. I can trust him to always be there for me. Again, he will not forsake me. He is also my provider. My provider. Again, think about Abraham in Genesis 22 and verse 14. It says that Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mouth of the Lord, it will be provided. Now remember, when this is. This is, he has gone up on the mountain. I often wonder what the conversation between him and Sarah was like the night before. Did you ever think about that? Without a doubt, there was some concern. There was some question. There was some kind of conversation that took place between Abraham and Sarah, because Abraham is going to take her only son and offer him as a sacrifice to God. There's got to be some kind of conversation going on. But Abraham, as they're traveling along, they've left the men and the donkeys behind, and they're going on to the mountain. And Isaac says, Father, here's the wood, the fire, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham's response is, the Lord will provide. I don't know. I don't know if I could have done that. I mean, that's a challenge to your trust in God, isn't it? It's a challenge in your faith to Him that He will always provide. Even in the most dire situation, and this is dire. And what do you know? The angel stopped Abraham, and there's a ram caught in the thicket over there, and there's the second God, the Lord provided, didn't he? The Lord provided. In Matthew 7 and verse 11, Jesus says, if you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? If I can give good things to my children, if you can give good things to your children, then how much more can the God of heaven, who knows all and sees all and is all powerful, do good for us and give to those who ask of him? Think about it. While the children of Israel were wandering in the wilderness, God provided for them everything. When they were thirsty, he provided water in Exodus 15. Bitter water, the water was bitter at Mirah, and they threw the tree into the water and wormwood, and it sweetened the water. In Exodus 17, he was told to strike the rock, Moses was, and it brought forth water. In Numbers 20, he was to speak to the rock, but he struck it instead, but still water came forward. When they were hungry, he provided the food, the manna. In Exodus 16, in verse 35, the sons of Israel ate the manna for 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. In fact, Joshua 5 and verse 12 tells us that the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate from the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. God provided for them. In fact, there wasn't anything that Israel lacked while they were 40 years wandering in the wilderness. Again, Moses reminds them of these things in his last speech to them before he dies on the mountain. In Deuteronomy 2 and verse 7 says, for the Lord your God has blessed you in all that you have done. He has known your wanderings through this great wilderness. These 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked a thing. In fact, in Deuteronomy 8 and in verse 4, Moses says, your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. And Nehemiah, in Nehemiah 9, reminds them in that day of these same things, that God had provided everything that Israel needed. God provides everything I need, and even provides me with some extras. God is so good. He is a wonderful provider. One of the interesting things about God providing, He provides what we really need. He doesn't always provide what we want because it might not be good for us. God is a mighty counselor. He gives advice for living your very best life. The advice God gives will always be best for you. You can have all kinds of counselors in this world, but they won't always know what's the best thing. But God always knows best. Again, Isaiah 9 and verse 6, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will be rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." Wonderful Counselor. And David says in Psalm 119 and verse 105, "The word, thy word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." The reason God guides us so well is because He's revealed Himself to us, and He has revealed that advice in His Word, in the Bible, to us. I would encourage you to note what Moses says God was doing for Israel while they were wandering that 40 years in the wilderness in Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter. In Deuteronomy 8 and in verse 3, He says, "He humbled you, and He let you be hungry, and He fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord." And isn't it interesting? When Jesus is tempted in the wilderness by Satan, in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, when Satan says, "Well, turn, you're hungry? Turn those stones to bread. If you're the Son of God, you can do that." And this is the very thing that Jesus quoted to Satan. "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." What God says is truly good for us. As I've listened to some reports, I'm not so sure that the food that they tried to feed us out of the supermarket is so good for us anymore. I'm afraid there are too many chemicals in it. They're getting me prepared for death before I get there. Half of the time, that's how I feel. But what God provides me with doesn't just provide me with the best way of living this life, but it provides me with the opportunity to be eternally with Him in heaven. There isn't anything better than that. You can't get better advice than that. And remember, God is always guiding us for our good, so that we might benefit. Again, the psalmist says in Psalm 73 and verse 24, "With your counsel you will guide me, and afterward receive me to glory." In Psalm 48 and verse 14, the psalmist says, "For such is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us until death. He will not forsake us." In Psalm 23 and verse 3, the psalmist says, "He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake." He guides me in that path so that I will bring glory to His name by living the way He has instructed me. In fact, God is my strength. I have no strength without him. In Ephesians 6 and verse 10, Paul says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. And that reminds me, both Moses and Joshua were told. Both of them were told. I'm not going to remember how it said. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. Why? Because God was on their side. I think about the number of times that Israel sinned and Moses fell down before God and pleaded for them. Because he was the only one to go to. God is the one who gives us real strength. In Christ, I have strength that can be found nowhere else. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 10, Paul writes, therefore I am well content with weakness, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. To see that in weakness there is really strength. In insults, in distresses, in persecutions, in difficulties for Christ's sake. In those weaknesses, in those times of great weakness, Paul saw that there was great strength that came from the Lord. In Hebrews 11 and verses 32 through 34, I'm not sure you'll see this, but I'll try to explain it. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, but put foreign armies to flight. As I think about this list, and I think about Samson being there, you know what? I'm just sure there's some religious person out there who says, what in the world is Samson doing in this list of faithful people? Well, he was a wicked man most of his life. He violated God's rules over and over again. And the thing that comes to my mind is that story that Jesus tells about the laborers. Some came early in the morning. Some came at the mid morning, some came at noon, and then some came in the afternoon, and then some came just before quitting time. Do you remember how the landowner paid him? He paid him all the same. You can look at Samson's life and you can see all of his physical failures. But you can see in his death, his confidence, his trust that God was there for him, that God was the one who gave him the strength and he was the one that he could rely on. I think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who's standing before the king of Babylon and tell him they're not careful how they will answer. They know what they're going to answer. We're not going to bow down to your great image. And I can remember reading how Nebuchadnezzar just becomes so vehemently angry. He tells them, commands them to heat the furnace 7 times hotter than, heated as hot as you can possibly get it. I think that'd be my way of saying it. In fact, it was so hot that the men were putting the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some of them even perished from the heat. And I've been close to fires. I used to throw wood on or brush onto a burning fire because we're cleaning up all of the mess that Dad had made with the chainsaw. And I'll tell you what, sometimes it gets so hot that you just couldn't get too close. You'd stand back a ways before you throw that on there. It's hot. I'm sure this was even hotter. Their strength came from where? They didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't know God was going to deliver them, did they? No. Their strength to serve God came from God. Their trust, their reliance on God in every situation. And I wonder, in 1 Kings 18 and 19, what if you would have been Elijah? What would you have done? In chapter 18, he has the greatest victory anyone I can think of ever had. He defeats the 400 prophets of Baal. It's a great victory. Surely the people are going to return to God now because they have seen that Baal is not God and that the Holy One is. Because Baal never answered. He didn't do anything. God, as soon as Elijah spoke, God answered. And he doesn't answer just a little bit. Everything is gone. God devours everything with that fire. He's had this great victory. And then in chapter 19, what do we find? We find him doing what? Hiding. Because the queen's after him. She wants to take his life. He's killed all of her prophets. She wants to get him really bad. What do you think Elijah was hiding? Why do you think he was really hiding? Here's the theory I have. He's had this great victory. He's shown the people who really is God. But nothing changed. Nothing changed. The people did not return to God. I can see Elijah in that cave, thinking he's the only one left. And God says, "What are you doing in here? I've got work for you. You need to get out. I need you to get this work done. I need you to get some things done. I need you to crown this or anoint this king and this king. And I need you to get another prophet to take your place because I'm bringing you home." But Elijah, I still have 7,000 who have not bowed their knee to Baal. Yeah. Maybe that's the way it was. I don't know. But God is a strength in times of great difficulty. And lastly, he's my friend. He's my friend. In John 15 and verses 13 through 15, we read, "Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you." In Proverbs 27 and verse 6, "The faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy." I think about James in James 2 and verse 23 saying that Abraham was called the friend of God. I think about the song that we sing from time to time. What a friend we have in Jesus. He's a friend that you can always count on being your friend. He's a friend that will not desert you. A friend who is always there. He went to the cross. He gave his life. He shed his blood. so that you could be saved. Our God is a great God. He is a great God. He is an awesome God. There is none like Him. And so I want to ask one last question. What is God to you? What is God to you? What does He mean to you? What is He to you? If your life's not right with God tonight, if you need to correct it in some way, we would encourage you this very evening to do that, because we do not know what time we will have left. We know that we have this moment. This may be the only moment that we have. We would encourage you, if you need to correct your life in any way, either to be baptized into Christ or just to correct some sin that may be of public nature, we would encourage you to do it as we stand to sing this song selected.